Today in Studio 360, for her latest album, the young superstar violinist Hilary Hahn tosses out the sheet music and just plays.
I tend to follow my instincts and I follow my interests in the projects that I do, and I think people understand that this is something that I really wanted to try.
And a new best-selling novel imagines the Earth's rotation mysteriously slowing down.
Time moved differently that Saturday. Already the morning felt like yesterday. By the time we sat waiting for the sun to drift down behind the hills to the west, it seemed to me that several days had passed inside the skin of just this one, as if the day had ballooned by much more than a single small hour.
And thus the world begins to end with a whimper. Right after this.
You're listening to the podcast of Studio 360 from Public Radio International and WNYC, where each week Kurt Anderson brings you great stories and conversation about creativity, pop culture, and the arts. We have a great website, too. Visit studio360.org to find out more.
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. Coming up on the show today, the famous violinist Hilary Hahn has been performing famous classical pieces since she was 12 years old. On her latest album, she tries something totally new. Hilary Hahn joins us to play live with the German composer Hauschka, and they'll be making up the music as they go along. But first, we're going to talk about the nightmare that took place in that movie theater in Aurora, Colorado a week ago. How long is the half-life of our horror and disgust over nightmares like this? I'm still trying to process it. Adam Gopnik has written about the Aurora massacre for The New Yorker, and he is here with me now. Adam, welcome back to Studio 360.
Good to be back, Kurt.
So you wrote in your piece shortly after the news of this happened that one of your kids was at one of those opening day midnight screenings of The Dark Knight Rises. This is your teenage son?
This is my teenage son, my 17-year-old, Luca.
And how did the conversation with him go after that next morning?
Well, to be honest, Kurt, we've had an ongoing conversation stretching out for the last 5 years at least about violence in video games and violence in movies. That is my saying, are you sure that this is a good idea to play Halo? Are you sure that the first Batman film is as good as you want it to be? Because I was concerned by those things. And he says, absolutely sensibly and correctly, look, there's a huge gap between the things we do in our imaginative life and the things we do in our actual life and so on. So it's oddly enough, we've been having this conversation at a reasonably detached level for a long time. But of course, as soon as I heard about it, something went through me. I don't know, honestly, Kurt, how I come down on the question about violence in the movies, violence in entertainment, and violence in the real world. It's a hugely complicated question.
Well, and it's interesting to me that show business people like to take credit for social progress. I think they correctly say, oh, look at the images of black people we put on television. Look at the images of gay people we put on television, and softened up the ground for actual real-life tolerance. And I think that's true. But when it comes to the potential more obscure downsides, no. Movies don't cause real-life violence.
The problem I always think when we talk about these things is that we want causality. And culture doesn't give us causality. It doesn't say, oh, well, if you stopped this, then this would
happen. Because that wouldn't be the case.
Right, exactly. But there's connectivity without causality. And that, I think, is what the problem is. The connectivity of a culture is a deep thing. We can say, it doesn't matter what it causes. It matters what it is. I don't want my kid engaged in the act of simulating mass killing, even if he grows up to be a college professor or a radio host or, God help him, a magazine writer.
Seems to me, tell me if you think this is crazy or not, over the last 50 years, since I was young, that the lines between fantasy and real life have become blurrier, and mostly in benign ways of online avatars and playing Farmville and dressing up in costumes and all the rest. But I feel as though it's easier for people to get over-invested in fiction and act out.
I agree, but I always recognize that our agreement is partly generational, and that if I look honestly at my own upbringing with two college professor parents, I had an armory. I had a man from Uncle Gun.
Playing
I had
war a, all yes, the time, for
right,
sure.
I had cap guns. Did you have cap guns, right, which actually made these little things? So anybody could look at us and say, these guys have amnesia about the theatrical violence, the imaginative violence in their upbringing. You know what I think is the big difference? Is that it used to be individual acts of violence. It was the roundhouse punch and the gun duel at the beginning of Gunsmoke. And now, if you haven't killed 60 people, you're not a villain in a movie any longer. It no longer even begins to count. A single death counts for nothing.
Sometimes these mass murders in other countries are similarly inexplicable without political motivation. But a year ago in Norway, there was this. The guy had political reasons. Why is it, do you think? Does it say something about America that these massacres here are without any politics?
That's a fascinating question. I hadn't thought about it very much. I suspect that there is something to be said that when people go crazy, they go crazy in the style of the place that they live. And you go crazy in Europe, and crazy in Europe is associated with politics. It's associated with ideology, most typically. So in a certain sense, it's natural for a psychopath in Germany to bend towards the neo-Nazis or towards the extreme right in Norway. In America, a less politicized country, we don't associate violence, perhaps. I'm thinking out loud.
I mean, there's Tim McVeigh 20 years ago.
But. Who did have a political ideology. But we tend to have fantasies much more of individual sort of self-expression through the annihilation of others. You know, it's a strange thing. I was watching an old movie called The Sniper from 1961, and it's pre-Oswald, but it's all about a lonely man. It's sort of the first lonely man with a rifle movies who expresses himself through killing people. And I do think that that's a powerful thread in the American imagination.
It's interesting, too, that in quite a few of these movies, including some of the Christopher Nolan Batman movies, the villains are motivated by a desire for massive media attention.
Yes, exactly. They're motivated to kill enormous numbers of people, huge numbers of people, in order to get attention for their own internal grievance. And the movie is always basically, your grievance may be reasonable, but your action is inappropriate. That's sort of the moral that Batman brings to it.
I know you don't see movies and TV shows and big pop cultural events necessarily when they're happening, but does this event make you not want to see, for instance, The Dark Knight Rises or lay off the ultra-violence in cinema?
Yeah, you know, look, I think Christopher Nolan's a wonderful filmmaker. I thought Inception was a fabulous film, and I'm sure that there's all kinds of artful and intelligent stuff in this that I would benefit from seeing. But how much do you have to benefit from it in order not to be a little bit revulsed by it? Is it incumbent on us always to pretend that we just love watching scenes of massacre and mass destruction? You know, somebody said, I remember after 9/11, oh my God, it was unimaginable. Well, no, it wasn't. It had been imagined over and over again for pleasure. It's only when it actually happens that you realize what its actual content is. And for me, at least, that kind of schizophrenic divorce between the actual content and the imagined content of our lives becomes uglier and uglier as I get older.
Adam Gopnik, thanks very much.
Pleasure to be here.
Adam Gopnik is a staff writer for The New Yorker magazine. Coming up, the writer Karen Thompson Walker grew up in Southern California, where it's always sunny and nice, and always one tremor or spark away from disaster.
At the beginning of every school year, we had to pack a Ziploc bag full of three
stuff.
Days of non-perishable food that we would eat if the big one struck while we were at school and we got stranded for 3 days. And I remember thinking, like, what situation is this where I can't get home to my parents for 3 days?
Now she's grown up and written a novel about a slow-mo apocalypse that nobody was expecting. That's in a minute in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us. This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. A couple of weeks ago, 2 milliseconds were added to the Earth's official atomic clock. If we didn't add these leap seconds to the official world clock every year, the experts say that time could stack up and ultimately, millions of years in the future, screw up the calendar entirely. But in the new novel, The Age of Miracles, the Earth suddenly actually slows down. Right now, the spinning slows. Each day and night become longer and longer by hours. And from her suburban cul-de-sac in Southern California, 11-year-old Julia tries to make sense of what's going on.
In the hours that followed, we would worry and wait. We would guess and wonder and speculate. We would learn new words and new ways from the scientists and officials who paraded in and out of our living room through the television screen and the internet. We would stalk the sun across the sky as we never had before. My mother drank scotch over ice in a glass. My father paced in the living room. Time moved differently that Saturday. Already the morning felt like yesterday. By the time we sat waiting for the sun to drift down behind the hills to the west, it seemed to me that several days had passed inside the skin of just this one, as if the day had ballooned by much more than a single small hour.
That's Karen Thompson-Walker reading from her new novel, The Age of Miracles. Karen, welcome to Studio 360.
Thank you so much for having me.
So the novel begins on the day of the slowing of the Earth, or the day that it's officially announced. How do you conceive this slowing? What is it and how did it happen?
Well, it's a mystery to the people.
And remains so.
Right, yeah. Right. You know, and that seemed more realistic to me, that if something we never expected to happen, you know, the sudden change in the rotation were to happen in our real world, it would take scientists a long time to figure out what the cause is. So in the book, part of what's so frightening about the slowing for the people experiencing it is that they can't explain why it's happening and they don't know how far it will go.
Which really, the fact that it's a mystery and what's going on and that it's not any of the things people were worrying about, it gives the novel its entire character, right?
Yeah, I mean, I wanted to write about that, what it's like to live in the face of this giant uncertainty. Which, you know, is not so different, just exaggerated from our daily life, I think.
You set up this interesting, one of the most specifically sci-fi-ish things, I suppose, that you set up is this looming battle between the real timers and the clock timers. And for listeners who haven't read Age of Miracles yet, explain what the real timers adhere to as opposed to the clock timers.
Right. So, you know, as the days grow beyond the 24 hours, then the clocks come out of sync with sunrise and sunset. And so eventually the government realizes or decides that the only way to prevent total chaos is to make sure everyone, or at least, you know, all the public schools and businesses adhere to a 24-hour clock, even though that means that, you know, children are going to school in the dark and people have to sleep in the light and it's just completely out of sync with light and darkness. But as soon as I made that decision, which seemed realistic to me, I knew that there would be some people who would resist it. And so they begin to call themselves the real timers. And those people feel that the clock has become artificial and they want to live, you know, in tune with nature.
And they're right. I mean, did you feel, I mean, I was thinking about myself in this world and thought, no, I would definitely be a real timer in that sense. And the idea of we're sticking to the 24 hours no matter what seems like so many political decisions today is we're just sticking with this way we've always done it, even though it makes no sense anymore. But I'm not sure. I don't believe I would have gone to Slab City and joined the commune. How do you feel about that if you were in this situation?
Yeah, I mean, I think at first, if it was only a slight an hour off of everyone else, it seems more appealing to me to be a real timer and just stay with the sun. But as the days, you know, they grow to 40 hours, it just becomes impossible if you live that way to interact with the rest of society because everyone's, you know, they're asleep when you're awake and things aren't open when you're awake. So I think for me, I'd probably be a reluctant clock timer and stay on the clock. With a certain sort of admiration for the people, the real-timers.
Exactly. Sympathetic liberals.
Yeah.
and we should point out that this isn't just an annoyance. It wreaks havoc with everything in the world, the food supply and everything else.
That's right. Yeah. Birds begin to fall from the sky. Whales beach themselves. Plants die. Crops.
Did the idea come all at once as a, oh, I had this idea for a story.
In a way, the concept of the slowing down of the Earth, or at least a change in the rotation and a change in the length of the 24-hour day, that did come at once after I read a newspaper article about back in 2004 following the earthquake that caused the tsunami in Indonesia.
Right. And they said that the Earth had slowed by a second.
Right, exactly. And it happened again actually last year after the earthquake in Japan. So even though that was a very slight amount, I began to think immediately, you know, what would happen if a much larger change were to occur.
Now that the book has been out for a few weeks, are scientists, geophysicists, and so forth weighing in on the plausibility of this scenario?
I haven't heard from anyone so far. I did, when I had a full draft, I showed it to an astrophysicist who, he was a really terrific reader, and he was kind of relieved by how much he felt was based in real science, and then he helped me fix a few things. So,
but did he buy the basic idea that this could somehow mysteriously happen?
Well, he doesn't know of a reason why it could happen so suddenly, but I think his view, and I think it makes sense for scientists, is that there's things that we expect and there's things that we don't expect, but there's always a chance that something that we don't see coming could happen, and then we would have to figure it out.
Right.
So he sort of, you know, as a reader of fiction, he could see it in that.
Yeah, so keep the black swan of this happening, but don't try to come up with a scientific rationale in specific terms.
Right, right.
Southern California literature, serious Southern California fiction, often tends to be about this sort of contradiction between sunny, breezy, nice Southern California and the looming dread of catastrophe. Nathaniel West, Joan Didion, Bruce Wagner. Apart from the fact that you grew up in Southern California, were you thinking of that, of the California versus the darkness of the idea?
You know, I don't know if I was thinking of it separate from this story, but certainly I do think there is something about living there. There is that's a true part of living in California, the combination of its beauty and pleasantness, but with this possibility of looming danger that only happens once in a while, you know, because of earthquakes and brush fires.
Which you grew up presumably worrying about.
I did, yeah, yeah. And I don't know if every child was as haunted as I was, but I was very haunted by it.
It made me think California children have something like the experience that I had growing up in the Cold War, thinking we could all be nuked tomorrow, which doesn't quite exist in the same way today.
Well, and the drills, you know, we would have earthquake drills at school. And one thing that I've always remembered is that at the beginning of every school year, and I think I put it in the book, actually, at the beginning of every school year, we had to pack a Ziploc bag full of three days of non-perishable food that we would eat if the big one struck while we were at school and we got stranded for 3 days. And the idea, I remember, you know, that was just sort of part of the back-to-school process. But I remember thinking, like, what situation is this where I can't get home to my parents for 3 days? You know,
really? And as like 7-year-olds, you're doing that?
Yeah, yeah. I don't know that they went into a lot of detail with us, but I,
yeah,
being a future storyteller, I guess, quickly imagined.
Yeah,
you know,
you got, I've read, a gigantic advance for this book. Gigantic in its own terms, gigantic certainly for a first-time novelist by somebody who wasn't previously famous. Has that had an impact on how you think of yourself as a writer, what you're going to do next, your work?
I mean, you know, obviously I feel very lucky. And then at the same time, it is a little distracting. So I try hard to sort of, I got a piece of advice once from my teacher, the writer Sam Lipside, who suggested that you should always, and this was when I was a student, you should always think of your writing career and your publishing career as two separate things, if you can. And I think he meant it in that moment for the times that might be disappointing in the writing life, when, you know, you feel like you're doing all this writing, but you're not having a lot of luck in the publishing world. But I have found that it really is just as useful when you've had a good piece of luck, because it really just has to always be about the writing every morning when I wake up. So I try to think of it as a separate thing.
You worked as a book editor.
That's right.
At Simon & Schuster.
Yeah, yeah.
As you were doing that and rising through the ranks and becoming an editor, did you always think, I really want to be writing the books?
Well, I always was writing.
Yeah.
You know, I was a writer sort of privately before I was an editor. So it was just sort of happening simultaneously that as I was moving up and becoming a full editor, I was also every day writing pages of my novel, although
uh-huh.
I wrote, it was slow, you know, more like sentences of my novel each
uh-huh.
morning.
Are you one of those writers who really can't move on until you get the sentence right?
Yeah, I would say. I mean, maybe not can't, but that's really, when things are going well, that's how I write. I wait until I've perfected a sentence, then write the next one, or maybe a paragraph,
uh-huh.
and that's the most satisfying way for me to work.
And you live in Brooklyn, where all writers live, and now you're moving to Iowa City, where lots of other writers live. How did that... First of all, how did you get from California to Brooklyn, and why are you going from Brooklyn to Iowa?
I moved to New York to do an MFA at Columbia.
Oh, I didn't know you had an MFA. That disproves my idea that MFAs don't equal success.
Well, I think that's fair to say they don't equal it. But I met some really great writers and important readers for my work, so
yeah.
It was very useful for me. But now we're, so it's, you know, I love New York. It's a little sad that we're leaving New York, but it's for an exciting reason, which is my husband, who's also a writer, he is going to be a student in the Iowa Writers Workshop. So we're moving to Iowa City for 2 years.
So your husband is now going to get his MFA, meanwhile being married to this hugely best-selling, important young novelist. What kind of tensions does that create in the household?
You know, I think we're really, I mean, people are always curious about that, but I think it's, the idea that there would be tension between us is maybe overrated. I feel like, in general, we're just each other's first reader and you know, like teammates. So he was really excited for me about the book, and I was really excited for him that he got into Iowa. And so hopefully that will continue.
Yes. Good luck with that. Karen Thompson Walker, thanks for coming in.
Thanks so much for having me.
The Age of Miracles is out now. So The Age of Miracles is about a child's experience of the world, but it's not really fiction for children. Unlike the new book by The Daily Show head writer Tim Carvel, Planet Tad, about a 12-year-old boy and his blog. Studio 360's Henry Alford wanted to find out how this grown-up's depiction of their lives looks to some real kid bloggers.
Lola Owett, who's 9 years old, would love for you to read the posts on her blog, Third Grade Writer, with one caveat.
Don't read the next one there or the one called Could It Be? Because it's really stupid. I was just writing, and I ate a lot of chocolate and coffee before that. So don't read that one.
Being a blogger between the ages of 9 and 13 is a delicate business. It's a really young age to be bearing your soul to an audience, even if some of that soul bearing takes the form of describing a recently acquired hair scrunchie. A few weeks ago, I asked Lola and two other young bloggers to read the new book, Planet Tad. Tad is a 12-year-old who starts a blog in hopes of attracting the attention of Natalie Portman. Lola and I were joined by Alex Casimir, who's 13. He writes fishslapsababyjr.com. Alex said that the part of Planet Tad that spoke to him the most was
the truthfulness of the pain of middle school.
9-year-old Gil Dominguez Letelier, whose podcast The Mutant Season is on Nerdist.com, told us his favorite part of the book was
yeah, how hard he has to live through with his sister, who's sometimes annoying, just like my little sister. And
which, of course, made Lola say
he reminds me of my brother.
Does he?
No, my brother's way worse.
Did Tad seem like a bit of a sad sack to you? I kind of wondered if, when he grows up, is he going to need a full-time nurse?
Definitely. there's this thing that happens with him being always like an airhead at times on how he picks on his sister Sophie without realizing it.
And everything goes wrong for him.
Yeah, and it's just, I think that's probably his biggest flaw. It's just that he doesn't really think things through. And who knows, maybe when he turns 18, he may go to college. He may live in his mother's basement until he's 40, and I don't know.
Or live in a stranger's basement.
He could live in a stranger's basement.
He could live like in a stranger's basement, but we're all getting kind of a basement vibe from this guy as an adult, aren't we?
You'd have to pay $400 every month.
To live in his mother's basement.
If blog posts are a kind of psychological Polaroid, and if kids are typically going through more changes than adults are, then it makes sense that when we look at kids' blog posts, we see a lot of personalities being forged and altered, being tried on and then discarded. When I asked the members of my bloggers roundtable why they blog, Lola said,
most people, when they have something to say, they would like go up to their friends or something and tell them, but I feel like I know them a lot and I can already predict what they're going to say back. So I just tell anyone who reads my blog, and I don't know them, so I don't know what they're going to say back.
Alex, how about you?
I blog because I'm incredibly bored at times.
Oh, my dear. Alex, why are you bored?
I'm bored because sometimes, you know, you just feel like doing stuff, getting something out. And I think blogging is the best exercise. Also helps you become a better writer as you go along and also lets you get a lot of problems out.
So there's a little bit of a therapy element to it.
Yeah, blogging can help somebody from get off the brink of insanity.
That's a big responsibility.
It is.
Well, you know, it's interesting because when I was a kid, we all kept journals or diaries, but we would never show them to anyone. That's totally different today. Have you guys ever gotten busted? Have you ever written something and then had someone read it and get mad?
Well, my last blog post I wrote was talking about how I just realized that my friend is actually really mean and is manipulating me.
Oh, no.
So I wrote about that, and then, by mistake, I put my crush at the back of it. And I never got the chance to delete it yet.
Oh, no.
Are you going to?
Yeah, when my mom gives me my computer back.
Well, what about your friend? Are you still friends with her?
Nah, I'm not talking to her. I was gonna yell at her, but the principal was sitting right next to me.
Oh.
I confess to the roundtable that sometimes when I blog, I notice that a different personality from my regular one emerges. I'm needier and more attention-seeking. I ask the bloggers if they experience the same thing.
I think when you're behind a keyboard at home, it has something to do with you being much more comfortable with whatever you're saying online rather than, like, in real life.
How is blog Alex different from real life Alex?
Blog Alex is very sarcastic and, like you, a total jerk online, so.
I see. You guys, one of the cool things about having kids here to discuss a kid's book is that kids' books are always written by adults. Do you think that this author, Tim Carvel, did he capture what it feels like to be a kid blogger? Did it seem accurate?
It felt a little bit different than what a blog would actually be because most of them don't say things like, I think the most upsetting nursery rhyme has to be Pop Goes the Weasel with the whole exploding weasel thing. I just read that out of the book. It's more like what went on in their day and stuff and
their Facebook updates.
Alex, you're saying that the book reads like Facebook updates?
Yeah.
I think it's just a lot of here's my opinion. I mean, yes, there's probably some here's my opinion, but I don't think there'd be that much, but I'm not in middle school yet, so I don't know. Maybe I'll become a blogger and do a lot of here's my opinions.
Everyone says the kids today don't read, but these kids clearly knew their literary genres. They can tell a blog post from a status update.
And their statements made me think that sometimes it's a lot easier to blog about how you think or feel rather than say it aloud.
I was kind of thinking about that part. It was kind of, how do I explain this? I'll think about it.
So maybe blogging, like tweeting, is a perfect vehicle for the vagaries of pre-adolescence. Monday, Jell-O again. I hate Jell-O. Tuesday, Jell-O again. Jell-O is awesome. In fact, maybe we all turn into preteens when we blog. We've all left the cafeteria, and we're all totally changing how we feel about Jell-O. With every blog post, we're practically a different person.
Is this your normal blogging?
No, I guess. I don't really. Good.
For Studio 360, I'm Henry Alford.
And at studio360.org, we've got some links to those kids' blogs. Coming up, a violin superstar teams up in real time with a composer and his piano full of duct tape and bottle caps. Hilary Hahn and Hauschka are next in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us. This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. A couple of weeks ago, I brought up an interesting Facebook post that my friend, the music critic Tim Page, had put up about really good classic pieces of music that he just didn't need to hear anymore because they've been played too much. Songs such as this, which is the first one I got tired of 25, 30 years ago. Pachelbel's Canon in D. This notion that even great songs need to be heard a little more sparingly, touched a chord, if you will. We got hundreds of comments nominating hundreds of songs. So we've put together our Studio 360 Do Not playlist. Lisa Matlock from Homer, Alaska says that like everyone, she loves Bruce Springsteen and Born in the USA, but it's been overplayed in all the wrong places, such as at sporting events and 4th of July celebrations. I remember when Ronald Reagan wanted to use it as a campaign theme song, which is weird, as Lisa points out, considering that it ends like this. Of you nominated not Leonard Cohen's Hallelujah, but all the cover versions it spawned.
I've heard there was a secret chord that David played and it pleased the Lord, but you
don't really care for music, do you? Well, it goes like this, the fourth, the fifth, the minor
fall, the major lift. The baffled king composing hallelujah.
A listener named Liz writes, it always starts out the same, sung softly, respectfully, and then builds to ludicrous heights of emotionality, as if the person is delivering the most important song in the world.
I've seen your flag on the marble arch. Love is not a victory march. It's a cold and it's a broken hallelujah.
And my Studio 360 colleagues have a few Do Not Play picks of their own. Our Alana Harper says this bass line from the Commodore's Brick House is one of the best hooks in funk music, which is maybe why the song has enjoyed such an afterlife in ironic blaxploitation-y videos. And this whole exercise raises an interesting question about exactly when a great song starts to turn bad. Now that we've got so many familiar song-heavy movie soundtracks, maybe we reach the oversaturation point more quickly. So we end our list with Adele, who's great, but what if we just put her hits away for a while and then enjoy them years from now, like fine wine? What do you think? Let us know at studio360.org. You may know Hilary Hahn as one of the top violinists in the world, a former prodigy who's been impressing audiences since she was 12, two decades ago. Lately, she's been stretching out beyond the standard classical repertoire, playing alongside pop musicians like Josh Ritter. But her new project goes the other way, into uncharted waters. Hahn is collaborating with the German musician Volker Bertelmann, who performs as Hauschka on specially messed up pianos. The music they make? Completely improvised. Their new CD is called Silfra, and Hilary Hahn and Hauschka are here with me in the studio now. So, Hilary, welcome. People are familiar with improvisation in jazz, but is this a kindred process, you and Hauschka making up the song as you go along?
For me, the improvisation part was a way to work in a shared project with Hauschka, because if we wrote something out, there would always be probably a leading voice in the composition, and we really had a chance to exchange ideas in a very nice way when we improvised. So my experience improvising started before this, but this kind of really from the ground up creative experience has been kind of exclusive to this particular collaboration. So for me, improvisation is a way to work together.
Well, let's hear you do it then. Go for it. Hilary Hahn and Hauschka improvising a piece of music that I love and which I guess shall remain nameless. So that, when you decided to play that, how were you able to talk about it? How did you know what was going to happen or where you should go with that?
Well, the original theme that Hilary started was coming up at some point during our rehearsals, and somehow it sticked with us all the time. So whenever we played somewhere, Hilary was just picking up the violin. She played like da 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 da. We just kept it as a kind of idea that we always.
All we had is the theme.
Yeah, so we just pull it out of the head, and then whenever we have fun to play it. To be quite honest, I think it's a very spontaneous way of living. I love that a lot, to just go into a situation and think about it quickly, not having too much fuzz about
and
anything.
And respond. And would it be, I mean, if you did that tonight or tomorrow, would it be different?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
We've been playing that theme into various pieces on the tour we've been doing, but it always turns out very differently. It could be that the theme belongs to something else, and that's why it keeps sticking in our heads. But as far as we know...
Until somebody tells you otherwise?
Yes.
You've been playing Hilary, performing since you were practically a baby. Are the techniques you've used for the last 20-odd years different than what you do in this project?
I learned to play the violin by playing classical music, and there's so much variety in classical music that even the unusual techniques I use to get sound out of the instrument at various times, various environments. Those also come from classical music. Mm-hmm. I've been playing a lot of contemporary music lately, but I wouldn't say that I'm improvising classical music. It's just that is how I relate to the instrument.
Right, right. And does doing this kind of music, this improvised music, affect how you play the classic pieces?
It definitely informs my playing because... On stage, a lot of interpretation, a lot of the individual choices you make about how to read what the composer is writing and then how to convey that to the audience, a lot of that has improvisatory elements in it because I'm not usually there by myself on stage. There are other people there with me, and they have ideas as well that are spontaneous.
But those improvisations are subtle,
though,
right?
Actually, they're kind of radical. If,
really?
If you compare one night to the next, I mean, a score is just a relative notation. Everything about a musical score is relative. So you can play with all the proportions. You can even interpret pitch. There really is no absolute, but it's the structure. So what I find interesting is when we play pieces that don't have a predetermined structure and we're forming that as we go, that's kind of what I'm doing with interpretation. I know kind of what I want to do. I have my general direction. I have the effect that I want to create. I have certain details I really like. And besides that, then I just try to be attuned to everything else that's going on. So these two things really, really do feed each other. And I feel like they both make me a better musician.
And Hilary, you have this enormous legion of fans for your classical repertoire. What do they make of this?
They can make of it what they like.
But what do you think?
I mean,
have you heard?
I don't know. I think people are generally supportive because I tend to follow my instincts and I follow my interests in the projects that I do. And I think people understand that this is something that I really wanted to try. It was a big experiment for actually us,
yes,
to do this.
It wasn't like... I mean, people are writing me sometimes as well, and they think, what is he doing? Does he want to jump out of the independent area, you know? Which is, everyone can think and take it.
So they think you're selling out and they think you're going crazy.
Well, you can think that
I mean,
if you want.
I don't think that's been the reaction.
No,
and
not at all.
The nice thing is that people are understanding that, for me, it's not that I went looking for this project and I found Hauschka to fit in it.
Mm-hmm.
It's more that we... got to know each other. We were friends. We wanted to work together.
Uh-huh.
What are we going to do together? Well,
right.
We might as well create something from scratch together because that's going to be a really interesting experience. And will learn more about music in the course of doing it.
So, Hauschka, you play what's called prepared piano. Can I come over there and you'll show me what that actually means?
Well, my friends laugh because whenever I'm writing, oh, prepared piano or prepared pianist, they're like, oh, so it's the unprepared pianist you usually work with.
This is a prepared piano. It's a piano that's open, and there's a whole, it looks like somebody dumped a kitchen drawer full of miscellaneous stuff into it. I assume it's not that random.
No, it's not that random. And if you see where I paste the things, they have a special place. So I'm using all sorts of material, like beer bottle caps. I'm using art erasers that are like more like, you know, they are damping the note like a wooden block, something like that. Then I'm using duct tape that creates more like a pizzicato kind of sound. Then I'm using like bells that are on the strings, and you see when I'm hitting the key, you actually, the bell creates another rhythm on top of that. So when I'm playing very fast, you have like a rhythm in the rhythm. These are felt mutes for strings, and they remind me always on an E electronic bass guitar that is picked with a plectrum. If I'm playing a scale, it's like...
That's cool to see it being done. Now, we have something else we want you guys to play. On Twitter, we enlisted people to come up with a tone row for you from which you can now improvise. But explain what a tone row is, since I don't have much of a clue.
It's a very niche bit of knowledge. A tone row, in basic terms, is 12 notes. There are 12 chromatic notes in an octave, in a scale. And the tone row is playing all of those notes back to back without repeating one. It's almost like a Sudoku kind of thing. And people look at it as an exercise, but I found that it's a beautiful melodic technique. And I've been making up my own in our improvisations, so I just thought it'd be fun to have some input from someone else to see what kind of tone row they came up with.
And the one you chose is by a guy named William Jeffrey, whose Twitter handle is WJ Composer. Why did it appeal? Why did you choose it?
I like that some of the notes are close together and others hop, but then there's kind of a swing, a little bit of a swing to the motion of this particular melody. So I just wanted to see what would happen. So we're going to do a little bit of improvisation on that.
Great. So we're going to hear Hilary Hahn and Hauschka improvising on a tone row submitted to us by William Jeffrey via Twitter. And I want to thank you both so much for coming in. This has been great and illuminating.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Hilary Hahn, violin, and Volker Bertelmann, a.k.a. Hauschka, on piano. You can hear the full version of this piece and another improvisation they performed for us at studio360.org. Their new record of very new music is Sofra. we're still interested in those old songs that you can't stand to hear anymore because they've been overplayed. We've got our Do Not playlist over at studio360.org, and you can still tell us what you want to add to it. That's it for today's show. Thank you very much for listening, and I hope you'll listen again next time. And until next time, you can listen to and read more stuff about art and music and movies and literature online. You can find us on Flipboard and on Google Currents and, of course, at studio360.org. And you can find me on Twitter at KB Anderson. That's Anderson with an E. Studio 360 is a co-production of WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International. Our production team includes
Vital Malad,
David Krasnow,
Michelle Siegel, Jenny Lawton,
Josh Rogerson,
Alana Harper,
Julia Barton,
Mujahid Solomon,
Eve Asher,
Julia Wetherill.
Thanks, as always, to WNYC's Chris Bannon. Our theme music is by David Van Tegum.
Studio 360 is funded in part by Ken and Lucy Lehman, who believe that winning workplaces respect, reward, and invest in their employees, and by the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes that a great nation deserves great art.
PRI, Public Radio International.
Next time in Studio 360, Woody Boyd was a bartender with dreams of making it in the theater.
Miss Howe, this is my golden chance. I have to do this. Don't you understand? I just gotta do it. I just gotta.
25 years later, the real Woody is taking on a new role. Playwright. Woody Harrelson talks about his off-Broadway show next time in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC.
You've been listening to Studio 360 with Kurt Anderson from Public Radio International and WNYC. You can find out more about this episode, access our entire program archive, and leave us a comment at studio360.org.